So I'd like to call this hearing of the Health, Finance and Policy Committee to order. Good afternoon, everyone. We are going to call the roll. We actually, I've been advised that we have a quorum, but I've also been told that we actually need to call everyone's names. So in order to do this really as efficiently as possible, I'd ask everyone right now to unmute. And then Ms. Niedernhofer is just going to call through the roll and just say present. And you don't need to repeat your name. And hopefully we'll get through it real quickly. Ms. Niedernhofer.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher. Backlund.
Present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner.
Bonner, present.
Bierman.
Bierman, present.
Holden.
Present.
Damoth.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grunhagen.
Present.
Heal.
Present.
Morrison. Morrison?
Present.
Munson?
Present.
Fryer?
Present.
Quam?
Present.
Ryer?
Present.
Schultz?
Present.
Wolgamott?
Present.
And Schumacher? I thought
Schumacher
I saw.
Present.
Okay, great. Okay.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. So we can now mute ourselves, please, and then use the raise hand function just like we've done in the past if members would like to ask questions. And remember that the staff will put your hand down if you do that after you've had a chance to ask your question. So the first thing on the agenda is to approval of the minutes of January 12th, 2021. Is there a motion to approve the minutes? I know you've all read them very carefully.
So moved.
All right, Representative Schultz, I think, moves the minutes of January 12th. Is there any discussion? This is about as basic as minutes get, I have to tell you. You haven't looked at them. Usually you should just make sure your name's on there if you were present. That's usually a good idea. And so hearing no discussion, all those in favor of approval of minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. And the minutes are approved. Thank you very much. So members, today we're going to continue with our overviews. And we're going to have today our first kind of focus on some of the finances that we deal with in this committee. And we've asked the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services to give us an overview of what's been going on financially during the COVID-19 pandemic, because it's pretty unusual and very complicated, but I thought it would be really helpful to ask them to come in and do this for us. So first, we're going to start with the Department of Health, and I understand that we have Margaret Kelly here to do the presentation. Ms. Kelly, are you here?
I'm Chair. I'm here along with Joshua Bunker, our CFO.
Okay, excellent. Well, welcome to the committee. I'm going to turn it over to you and let you go through your slides.
Thank you. I'm going to start the presentation. And for the record, my name is Margaret Kelly. I'm the Deputy Commissioner, Chief Operating Officer at the Minnesota Department of Health. And thank you for the invitation to come today and talk about all the resources that have been flowing through MDH for COVID response. So just to set some context for all of you on the committee, we've been at this for almost a full year now. We stood up our internal incident command team on January 29th last year in anticipation of coronavirus showing up in Minnesota. And for those of you who are unfamiliar, an incident command structure is simply a way to manage the organizational communication response of a crisis. We oftentimes use incident command to coordinate across divisions within the agency, specifically when we have a flood or when we have some sort of an outbreak, a foodborne illness outbreak or some other outbreak. This is the biggest endeavor we have ever done. So we stood up our incident command on the 29th of January and quickly realized that this pandemic was going to overwhelm the department's ability to respond. And on March 3rd, we established what we call a unified command with Homeland Security and Emergency Management within the Department of Public Safety. And they operate out of the state's Emergency Operations Center. And a unified command is where we sent our commander down to the SCOC to work along with Director Joe Kelly to leverage the resources across the across all agencies and across state government, and to coordinate with the federal government and local units of government. On March 6th, we did have our first confirmed positive case of COVID-19 in Minnesota. We've come a long way since then. We are up in the 400,000 range now. And on March 15th, the State Emergency Operations Center was fully activated with all affected agencies having representatives at the EOC. Next slide, please. So within the Department of Health's emergency or incident command structure, we are focused on a variety of activities and coordinate across the department in the area of like laboratory analysis, doing the testing and confirming cases, surveillance across healthcare systems to understand where what is happening with the virus and to do the epidemiology work around the virus and the case investigation when we learn of positive cases to help us to manage outbreaks in the community. Data management, there is an enormous amount of data that we are pushing out to the public, and we are trying to coordinate that as best we can through our incident command. We have stood up a public hotline. We have stood up a team of people to do outreach to cultural, faith, and disability communities. We are coordinating with local public health, with tribal health, and with the healthcare systems. We are coordinating our activities within long-term care to ensure that we can manage the outbreaks within those facilities. We have stood up daily media calls, and we issue thousands of documents so far around guidance and to give people assistance and understanding what they need to do and what they can do to stay safe in this environment. We have about 1,500 employees at the Department of Health, and about 70% of them have been reassigned or redeployed within our command structure to do this work. In addition, we've leveraged through contracts and redeployments within state agency several hundred more staff to facilitate with us. On case investigation alone, we have 1,000 people working on that at any at the peak we did. Next slide. At the state emergency operations level, the response is more coordinated across state government. It leverages the capacity at other state agencies as well as local units of government. And we have set up work groups to help us with community testing, something that is not a part of the daily activities of MDH. We have never done testing before viruses like this. We leave that up to the healthcare system or to local public health. And so a work group at the SCOC stood up our community-based testing strategy, along with our long-term care testing strategy and providing staffing supports to those facilities that were at times without staff because of COVID. We also coordinating within healthcare through our state healthcare coalitions and coordination. We have membership from the healthcare systems and the hospital association at that table in the SCOC. All of our critical care supply work was coordinated through the SCOC. And we have assistance from MDH around state agency redeployments so that we can have the staff we need at MDH or the SCOC or other agencies to meet the demands of this response. And we're also coordinating at that level with some of our at-risk populations and among the homeless and among incarcerated adults and juveniles. Next slide, please. So we have already started learning some lessons, some early lessons from our COVID response. While we have done a lot to prepare ourselves, this pandemic has been unprecedented, and our preparedness needs to be revamped and based on actual experiences. So we will do a lot of analyzing how we responded here to be better prepared if and when something like this happens again. This is my first pandemic, and I'm hoping it will be my last as well. We are learning a lot about the responsibilities of public and private sectors, and that there needs to be clarity between who is responsible for what. Defunding public health infrastructure over the past 10 plus years has left significant gaps in our ability to respond. We have needed to rely on resources both at the state level and the federal level. Otherwise, we would not have been able to do even a tenth of the work that we've been doing these past 12 months. The lack of healthcare coverage and the lack of paid sick leave has contributed to the spread on this virus, and it has created inequitable outcomes. People have not stayed home when they're sick because they did not have sick leave coverage to do that, or felt that they needed to work. And so that has contributed to the community spread in this virus. And we've also found a lot of inefficiencies in our healthcare system, and it can lead to the lack of healthcare, it can lead to the lack of capacity for healthcare surge. Our healthcare systems run pretty lean, which is what we all want during normal times. But that means that they don't have that surge capacity that we desperately need at times like this. And COVID-19 has exacerbated all of the known inequities that we have talked about for years, healthcare, health inequities within our systems and within our communities. And they have just been exacerbated with COVID-19. We have learned a lot about how to work better with some of those communities, and it's for the department one of our highlights so far. One of the shining lessons learned from this pandemic is how we can better engage with communities around health inequity, health disparity issues. So, next slide. So now we're going to get into some of the financing. That's what Chair Liebling asked us to speak to today. We have a variety of sources of funding that have come to the department, and we will walk you through each one of those. The largest of which came from the Federal CARES Act, Coronavirus Relief, known as the CRF, or Coronavirus Relief Fund here at the state. 32% of our funding, almost $275 million, going through the department from that funding source alone. We have gotten a lot of distinct federal grants as well, specifically that are not from the Coronavirus Relief Fund, which contributes another 20% to the spending that we've done, almost $172 million there. The healthcare response is a general fund appropriation made last session to the department to push resources out to the healthcare system so that they would have the resources, the capacity, the equipment that they needed to respond. $140 million initially was $150 million, and $10 million was refinanced during one of the recent special sessions. The COVID-19 fund is general fund resources, again, set up during last session before the series of special sessions, resources to a $200 million pool of resources that the Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget worked with agencies in the legislature to allocate. And we have grown the pot there, so to speak, through insurance reimbursements for testing, but $196 million came to the department through that funding source. And finally, public health emergency response account, which is the one source of funding that is embedded in the department's budget for responding to communicable disease outbreaks. This was a pot of money that the legislature, I don't recall how long ago, maybe 6, 7, 8 years ago, established when we were faced with Ebola coming to the US. And typically we have about, it was initially established with $5 million. And we had spent some of that down over the years. We had about $4 million. And the legislature added 20-some million to that to bring it up to $25 million in January of last year. And another $50 million a few weeks later for emergency response within the healthcare system specifically. And so that is the whole $857 million of spending to date that we are working with. And I, next slide, please. So we are going to walk through each of these funding sources. I just want to add that our strategy has been that we would use federal funds before we use general funds, that we don't want to leave federal funds on the table, but we're happy to leave general funds on the table. At the same time, from a federal funds perspective, we have used every CRF dollar at our disposal since that intended to expire on the 30th of this past month. Those funds have been extended to another 12 months, but our goal was to use up coronavirus relief funds before other federal funds and certainly before general fund resources. And we did that in part to ensure that we would have resources beyond the 30th of December, so that we could extend other federal grants make other grant sources last longer, so that we would have resources into this year to respond to COVID. The other thing I want to add is that we have several reports coming your way. Appropriation language from last year, statutory language within our public health emergency response account, all asked for the department to report by January 15th of this year on what resources we received and how we have used those resources. And so we have a lot more detail coming your way when those reports will be issued to you all later this week. And rather than ask staff to hurry up and provide that detail, we're keeping it relatively high level now, and you will see more detail when those reports come your way. Next slide, please. So we're going to jump into some of the detail within each of those funding sources. Joshua, I'm going to turn it over to Joshua Bunker, our Chief Financial Officer. Before he starts, I'm just going to pause and see if there are any questions. If you want to do that now, Madam Chair, or if you'd like to just wait.
Yeah, I think now would be a good time if anyone has questions. But I don't necessarily see any, though. So I think we can, oh, I see Representative Hewitt has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Deputy Commissioner Kelly. Just a real quick question, and we're getting lots of comments on this from constituents. It seems like everybody has their own set of data. How do we know that the state data that we're using is the best data out there?
Madam Chair, Representative Hewitt, I have confidence in our data. All positive cases of COVID. I do have confidence in our data, but we are constantly reviewing it for errors and omissions and making corrections. That said, there's a disease reporting requirement in state law that there are a set of diseases that if detected need to be reported to the Minnesota Department of Health. And we have a reporting system in place with hospitals and with healthcare clinics. And those are things like the measles. So if somebody is diagnosed with measles, that needs to be reported to the Department of Health. And the coronavirus, COVID-19, is a reportable disease in that system. And so we have a long-standing reporting structure put in place that is being used right now. That being said, there are providers of COVID tests that are coming online every day who are not familiar with Minnesota's reporting requirements and who may not have ever reported before to a state or certainly to Minnesota, and who may not have electronic reporting in place, which is what we rely on from our partners. And so we are constantly reaching out to find out who has the data, making sure that we're getting it, making sure that it is accurate, and we're doing the best. But we are overwhelmed with the number of cases at times, especially during the peak. And we are continuing to add staff to that group so that we can keep up to date. I hope that is helpful.
Madam Chair, just to follow up.
Representative Hewitt.
And Deputy Commissioner Kelly, I know that you are doing a great job. I mean, this is unforeseen times, and I want you to know that I truly believe that you are doing what's best, and the data you're using is the best out there right now. So I appreciate your hard work. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. So were we going to go through the document that's in front of us right now? I'm sorry, Ms. Kelly, I almost missed him. Mm-hmm. I had Representative Bierman had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Deputy Commissioner Kelly, my question was just in regards to one of your comments on the defunding of public health infrastructure. And I just wondered if you could comment on maybe some examples of what that has been that you are thinking about over the, you know, that has been defunded over the past 10 years that made this even harder to battle the COVID-19.
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, we have not included a slide like that. We'd be happy to come back with some data around that. But gradually over the last 10, 15 years, there has been the funding for public health, both at the state level and at the local level, has not kept pace with the rate of inflation and the cost of delivering services. And so the funding that we do have dedicated, its effectiveness has been eroded. In addition, we used to receive funding from the federal government for very broad purposes for emergency response. At the federal level, that funding was also reduced. And now the funding that we receive, while in aggregate is similar in the amount, is very specific and is only for planning purposes. And so we don't have the broad sources of resources to do more general strategic planning and practicing that we have had in the past. And that erosion has been evident in our ability to quickly ramp up and take action both at the state level and at the local level.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. We can move on.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Bierman. I think that's an excellent question. And just for us as policymakers to be thinking about this, prevention and having structures in place for things that may not ever happen is a really hard thing to do, to allocate for, you know, politically in the widest sense of that word. It's very hard to do because when you prevent something, everybody thinks it just didn't happen just because. They don't realize that it was because of the money you invested and the work you did. So it's really a challenge, but I hope that when we, as we go forward out of this pandemic, that we remember as policymakers the importance of being prepared and putting the dollars and the work into these things that if they work well, no one will ever really thank us for them. That's the way it should be, right? So I'll let you go on, Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Bunker now to walk us through these PDF documents. You should all have them in your hand. We're going to start with number 7, I believe, is the COVID Minnesota Fund.
And just for members, when Mr. McQuillan, the CA, sent these out, he did number the documents for ease of use for you. So if you go to the email that he sent, you can open the correct document if you're trying to do that.
Go ahead, Joshua.
Madam Chair and members, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Joshua Bunker, I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Health. We will have five documents to walk through. I'll try to walk through them smoothly, but rapidly, because I know there are more items on the agenda, and to allow for any questions. The document in front of you, as Deputy Commissioner Kelly stated, is number 7 in your packet, and I'll let you know which number on the header of the document we're on each time. Document number 7 is the COVID-19 Minnesota Fund, and this was the fund that again was brought to bear very early in the pandemic in March with funds. And the appropriated actions will show up on the far left of the document. Let me just state briefly that you will see indication of LCRC and MNB approvals. The LCRC approvals were for those amounts that were over $1 million, and the MNB actions were for those items that were under $1 million. And for two of these items, you will also see an LAC and the number 95, which is a recent refinancing between COVID-19 Minnesota funds and CRF, and I'll point those out as we go.
And Mr. Bunker, if you could just tell people what that LCRC thing is, I'm sure most members don't know.
I apologize, Madam Chair. The LCRC stands for Legislative COVID-19 Resource Commission, and that is an approval body similar to the LAC, Legislative Advisory Committee, which others may be more familiar with, that is focused upon approval of the COVID-19 Minnesota funds and is staffed by chairs of committees. And I apologize that at this time I'm not remembering all of the chairs of the committees that are part of that from both House and Senate for an approval group. The next column over, moving toward the right, is an indication of the group that is responsible for coordinating and managing those funds. And so you will see in a number of times SEOC, which is State Emergency Operations Center. And there are a number of work groups that are working out of the SEOC. And so you see those indicated. Authorized at the top of the document will be an amount after some of the final refinancing. Encumbered and expended is present amounts, actually I should say as of December 31st, amounts, available balance is just that. The refinancing impacts, if there is refinancing, we'll note that and talk through that quickly, and then just some notes on what is included within those categories of items. So with that, the first item down is critical care supply needs, and you'll see that that's coordinated by the SELC's critical care supply work group, a $66.6 million amount after some refinancing with an available balance of just under $4.3 million. In this area, $31.6 million of expenses were moved from these state funds onto the coronavirus relief funds. So that is the refinancing, and that would be the motion of dollars mostly from COVID-19 Minnesota to CRF so that we can spend those federal dollars first, as Deputy Kelly stated earlier. And of this, there was a cancellation within these funds that reduced the available amount. You'll see the items on the side. These are for all manner of PPE and other items, ventilators, equipment that went to hospitals really to take advantage of the state's buying power and position in purchasing to leverage these items for the state. The next item down is COVID testing. That was brought about by two actions of the LCRC, managed by a testing work group at the SEOC, with $72 million that was used, a remaining encumbrance of $32.3 million. And you'll see $39.7 million is available. That was a very recent allocation in whole for testing strategy, infrastructure, and response costs. That was just 2 weeks ago that those monies were made available. Of those amounts, $3.7 million was moved from expenses over to the CRF fund, the COVID relief fund, coronavirus relief fund, sorry, and that was to take advantage of the federal match. So those monies were moved over, and we are waiting at this time for the 75% of offsetting expenses to come back and reimburse us in the state for those expenses. You'll see a note there as well that there has been $19.5 million coming back from insurance reimbursements on tests that were performed at Mayo and the U of M to date. Those amounts we expect to continue to come in and offset our testing costs in the state as we move into the next months. And then the notes again of what those expenses were made of. You see the first $36 million actually were contracts that were put in place March and April with Mayo and the U of M to begin this process. Moving down to the next line of testing supplies, that also was managed by an SELC work group with an amount of right around $1.8 million, $526,000 showing up in the available balance column. There was a correction of a little over $5.2 million refinanced to the coronavirus relief funds. And really, these are swabs and collection kits that show up in this area. Alternative care site monies, again, managed by an SELC work group, with just under $1 million available, with $500,000, moved over as match to FEMA amounts that we're waiting for to CRF funds. And this was for alternative care sites, medical placement at VA hospitals, ensuring beds were available for overflow. Long-term care costs, managed again by an SELC work group, with $1.2 million available now. Those monies are still being used to cover costs for related expenses, mobile testing teams that have to do with long-term care. Community engagement and outreach is primarily a diverse media effort. Those monies were all used, and $135,000 were used and moved over to the Coronavirus Relief Fund for match against anticipated federal reimbursement. Again, this was communicating with organizations, getting the message out related to testing. Redeployment funding, as Deputy Commissioner Kelly mentioned, we have had hundreds of people participating in this effort. In this particular line, we'll see costs for case investigation and contact tracing, and costs for staffing at the State Emergency Operations Center covered by this item. In this line, you will see that we still have an amount that is paying for these activities now moving into the beginning of 2021. And finally, there was recently an allotment of monies for vaccination-related efforts. Those two amounts were a $200,000 amount for swabs and cotton balls and things like this used during the vaccination process, and then the $39.758 million for vaccination strategy, infrastructure, et cetera, to get this process moving. And that is the end of this particular document. I'll be moving next to document number 5, unless there are any questions for me.
So just not really a question, Mr. Bunker, but I just want to make sure that to kind of frame this for members, that the fund that you were just talking about, the COVID Minnesota fund, that was the $200 million, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And just so members, that fund, remember back in the days when Rita really didn't know what was coming, and the administration asked to have some money they could use flexibly to meet the emergency. And so this was that fund. And this part that Mr. Bunker mentioned, the, what did we call it? I always get these acronyms, the LCRC.
Yes, Madam Chair.
So that was something the legislature put in to have some oversight. There was an attempt to, you know, rather members were understandably nervous about just handing over $200 million to the administration and saying, here, spend it however you want. So that was kind of the control mechanism, was that there was this group of legislators who could kind of act as a veto if they all got together and decided something needed to be vetoed. But nothing ever was vetoed, to my knowledge, but that's what that is about. And so thank you for that. Why don't you go ahead on to the next one?
Madam Chair, thank you very much. We are moving now to the coronavirus relief funds. Actually, I'm sorry if you could scroll up just a touch so we can catch the first item. Thank you very much. This document is laid out in much the same way as the other. You will see the appropriations, but instead of the LCRC, you will see Legislative Advisory Committee that was put together to review these funds. These were the, I believe it was in the neighborhood of $1.9 billion worth of coronavirus relief funds that came into the state. And so similar with other federal grant review, the LAC was the approving and reviewing body for these items. In the first line, you'll see the critical care supplies managed again by the SEOC. There was an authorization amount beginning of $45 million. There is a zero balance right now at this time. On the last document, I indicated that $31.5 million were moved from the COVID-19 Minnesota fund onto this, and so that was part of using up the remaining balance of these monies. And you'll see the uses again were consistent with the COVID-19 Minnesota funds, gowns, gloves, masks, face shields, et cetera. The testing services and supplies managed by an SEOC work group, there is a $132.5 million remaining appropriation or authorization, and $13.5 million remaining. The notes include an increase of money, some expenditure offsets from COVID-19 Minnesota Fund, and now an extension of these monies to be able to use against continuing testing efforts in the state. And you'll see the uses in this includes community testing sites, rent, on-demand for teacher testing, those types of things. And then you will notice the latest amounts in the U of M Mayo and Vault saliva contracts right now. And while there is a remaining balance at this time, we are still waiting for November and December invoices to be put against that remaining balance. Seroprevalence research was one request for right around $2 million. It remains $1.2 million left after a reduction of amounts that was used for grocery and healthcare worker surveys, blood bank studies, as well for research purposes. The case investigation, contact tracing, staffing, and IT costs, those were just under $40 million effort authorized right now with $1.6 million remaining. Balances in this account will continue to be used for like efforts in these next month or two. After that, these monies will have been used. You see then a description of the uses for these funds. There was a $8,750,000 media campaign that was the Stay Safe campaign. Those monies will be completely used after we pay the final invoices. The long-term care testing supports, again managed by SEOC, you'll see a balance remains. Those monies will be used to continue work in those areas and specimen collection, SEOC staffing, and other items related to long-term care testing will be included there. You can scroll down just a touch, please. You'll see the next item is staffing for MDH. That was a $25 million amount to cover costs of staffing that were not anticipated at the beginning of last fiscal year. And so those monies were used to cover staff expenses where we did not have a normal source of funding that could be used against those expenses. There is an item for $12.5 million for grants to local and tribal public health and healthcare systems. In the notes for this section, in the second to right column, you will see here the last mention There was a $10 million correction in the fifth special session where coronavirus relief funds were used instead of the healthcare response funds to create some general fund savings, and I'll point those out when we get to that fund as well. But it's notable here that $10 million were moved over for that purpose. The last two items, the total of expenses in these areas were expenses moved from COVID-19 Minnesota onto CRF to cover the 25% FEMA match for both of these areas. So again, we're waiting for the 75% to come back from these areas. Any questions on the coronavirus relief fund document?
So I don't see any questions yet, Mr. Bunker. So I would just say for members, again, and this is, you know, there's a ton of detail here. But I think the important thing to understand is just this was the federal fund, the large federal fund that first fund that Congress authorized. And a lot of that money was allocated to states and to local governments. And it came with strings attached in the sense that you had to use it for things that were related to the coronavirus. And maybe, Mr. Bunker, maybe you can just give us a thumbnail of exactly what that requirement was. But this also, as you can see, this LAC, and I was part of that because whenever the state accepts federal funds, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Bunker, but that there's the legislature has to approve accepting federal funds. So now, some funds are already approved in statute so that we don't actually have to do anything more. But others, when they come in, there has to be some kind of process for the legislature to accept the funds. So in any event, this is what the LAC was. It was kind of a different members were on that group depending on the subject matter of the expenditure. And it was kind of an ability to veto it, is essentially. But we had a lot of briefings over those seven special sessions. I don't know if any of you who were members had any time off, but some of us were kind of constantly reviewing expenditures and trying to understand what was happening across all these different areas. Mr. Bunker, did I say anything there that was not accurate?
Madam Chair, spot on.
Okay, great. I see we have a question from Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Bunker. Just a quick question about the third line from the bottom. I just wanted to make sure I understand that the tribal grants, was that just simply a shift or was there also a reduction? And if you could just clarify that, please.
Mr. Bunker.
Madam Chair and Representative Ryer, you'll see in the notes that there was just a mention of an $11,000 reduction in the amount that was allocated for travel grants. So that was just a tiny bit at the end that when the allocations worked out, some of the decimal points. Yes, yeah, so that was it.
Okay. Anything else, Representative Ryer?
No, nope, thank you. I got used to lots of numbers.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. All right. I think I don't see any other questions on this, so we could move on.
Madam Chair, thank you. And members will be moving now to document number six. Whereas the coronavirus relief funds certainly are federal funds, the document we're looking at now are supplemental funds from our federal funders, the primary areas we've received money from, where pandemic-related supplements, if you will, were received by the state to address the response. So still federal dollars and still monies that were approved through the Legislative Advisory Committee process as well, through the LAC process. This is one of the areas where there will be a legislative report completed by the end of the day on Friday. And shared with you. And so I will just be discussing and presenting the areas of funding now and the total amounts of those awards that we've received in the state. The expenditures and other distribution uses will show up on the 15th. So you'll see on this document, again, which is document number six, you will see the funding agency. And as Deputy Commissioner, Kelly pointed out to me, really in many ways, all of this is federal level health and human services, but through sub-agencies, if you will, CDC and FIRST as we go. So in the first line, you will see an emerging infections program, approximately $2.7 million, and that was to work on preparation for a lot of data informatics, a lot of data reporting. Minnesota is one of 10 states in the nation that is part of the CDC's Emerging Infection Network. And so these monies were used in preparation of the data exchange that is required by the pandemic itself. And I should mention, for most of these items, they really do not come in the form of a block grant, if you will, where we receive money and then determine how to spend these monies at the state level. The majority of them are defined as cooperative agreements, which by federal definition means substantial involvement by the federal agency. And so there is a process of submitting a work plan that, in the case of the items you see at the top of the page, the CDC would actually approve, and we would negotiate with them. So these are not just monies that come in and then we decide where we would like to spend them at the time, but instead in a very planful way with an agreement with CDC.
That's great. And Mr. Bunker, if I could just pause you right there for a minute. So we only have about five more minutes left in your segment here. And I know members can read through this, and it's great having it on the screen. It's small, but I can still read it. I hope other people can too, or they might have the other copy available to them. I guess what I would do is, how many documents now? I've lost track a little bit. Which ones are you going to go through yet?
Madam Chair, I can just introduce this document in the next two within 5 minutes.
Okay, well, that's great. And I just wanted to bring up, when we're talking about this, with these other federal funds outside of that coronavirus relief fund, that this, we in our presentations we've had recently, we learned that a lot of funding for the Department of Health actually comes sort of in this way, even under normal times, right? So this is not such a strange process for the Department of Health. It's kind of your everyday business of bringing in money, a lot of it federal money, to do specific projects, correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay.
And so the majority of these grant areas are ones in which we would have added on the supplemental activities. So a cooperative agreement would be in place, and then those would be amended with additional dollars to focus on pandemic-related activities. And as you look through the top of the document, you see items such as sexual violence prevention and suicide prevention that may seem a little other than anticipated. However, some of these are the public health impacts during times of pandemic. Other grants underneath, further down on the sheet, have items where you may feel they're more traditional pandemic response, a lot of testing, data systems, informatic grants to local and public health and healthcare systems, and then moving in at the very bottom of the page, I believe we get into an amount that is for, yes, hospital preparedness. So the majority of a number of these grants or amounts at the bottom of the page actually go directly out to healthcare systems themselves.
Okay. And Representative Bierman had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Bunker. My question is, thank you for all of this information. I'm just wondering, when we talk about the emergency powers in the state of Minnesota, there's often the discussion about the $50 to up to $80 million a month that we obtained for being in a state of emergency. And I'm just wondering if there's a way to describe how any of this money may be part of that. And if this is off the track of the topic, we can talk about it at another time.
Mr. Bunker?
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, are you referring to the uses of money for emergency powers?
So not so much the uses, but just the simple fact that Minnesota is one of the states in a state of emergency. I was I've heard that there's certain monies that, since we're in a state of emergency, that we qualify for, just by having that state of emergency in existence. Whereas if we go out of a state of emergency, then we are going to lose a broad swath of federal funding. And I'm wondering if this is part of that.
Mr. Bunker, I'll jump in here because Representative Bierman, I think I know what you're referring to. I do know what, it's a great question. And I think it might be better answered by Human Services, because I think you're talking about, I might be mistaken, but I think it's the enhanced federal match for MA that forms part of that. And that would be a DHS thing rather than a something in health. But that's a great question. Let's hang on to that and get it answered. Thanks.
Appreciate that. Thanks.
Okay,
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you. We'll move now to document number 4, the Healthcare Response Fund. This was the $150 million that was initially appropriated to address needed healthcare response improvements and items. And on this page, I am just showing documentation of the actions that were used and the grant amounts. You will see in the middle column that there were approvals for grants that were over $1 million and approval for under $1 million, and that was included within statute. This will be another one of those areas in which a legislative report will come out on Friday that will provide the details and the hundreds and hundreds of grants that were funded under this authorization. In the middle of this page, you will see an action on October 16th, where $10 million was appropriated. This is where $10 million of grants were shifted from this fund off to the Coronavirus Relief Fund to create some general fund savings. Madam Chair, any questions on this document?
Right. And I would just, so again, I don't see any questions, but I would just point out to members, if you recall, those returning members, these were some of the last things we did before we kind of fell apart because of COVID as a legislature and kind of went home to do things remotely. And so if you remember, there was a great deal of concern about the readiness of our healthcare systems and whether they were going to have the resources to be able to meet the demand. Because remember, again, at that point, we really didn't have a lot of real data or real understanding of what was going to be hitting us. So this is probably, if you have a small hospital or a large hospital where you are, they probably got some of this funding, and the Department of Health has put an enormous amount of time and energy into distributing this money and trying to figure out, you know, how it could be best utilized. So I'm looking forward to seeing that report, because I know we did inject a lot of resources into our healthcare community. And just really interested in seeing how that funding was used. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for members, at the very top of this document, you see a very brief description of a number of the recipients. So that's for your reference. The last document then I will go through quickly is document number 8. Thank you very much. So the Public Health Emergency Response Account was described briefly by Deputy Commissioner Kelly at the very beginning of her comments, that it was established a number of years ago. However, there were noticeable infusions of money into that account for purposes that you see below. The first item, the emergency response grants, this $50 million amount that was appropriated in March was paired up with the $150 million that we just spoke of from the Healthcare Response Fund. And that turned into approximately $200 million that indeed did go out the door for responding to, preparing for, et cetera, for healthcare systems. Those grants are all either out the door or the last transactions are being done right now to get them executed with recipients. Let's scroll down just a touch. The last portion is also an area where we will be sharing comments on the legislative report. This is just a summary right now. As Deputy Commissioner Kelly mentioned, there was a transfer of just under $21 million. It gave us an account balance of 25.5. At present, you are just seeing the way that these monies are laid out by expense type area. Now, as we have opportunity to reimburse the state from received federal awards, we will offset some of these expenses to create general fund savings according to the earlier agreement to do our best to spend federal funds first. However, in terms of process for responding to the pandemic, promise of federal funds wasn't always timely in terms of when we needed those funds present to spend on a particular something. And so we would use the funds within this account to get activities moving, and then we would offset them when the federal funds were received. That process of moving expenses and making expense corrections will continue to take place over the next perhaps 4 to 6 months. That concludes our financial pages. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Bunker. Well, there is a question from Representative Grunhagen. Representative Grunhagen, we're not hearing you.
Oh, there can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to clear something up. You know, Representative Bierman said that we have to be in an emergency status to receive enhanced federal match. Well, according to my staff, that's not true. So I think we do need to clear that up. There are strings attached, but you do not have to be in emergency status. So I'm not trying to impugn Representative Bierman in any way, because we know there's a ton of information on this, but it would be good to clarify either by one of the testifiers or maybe yourself, Madam Chair, or maybe staff research would have to look into it. I think we need to know whether we need to be in an emergency status to get a federal match or not.
Well, Representative Grunhagen, I'm not really sure if my statement was correct, but we have Mr. Greenman coming next from DHS, and he knows a whole lot more about these things than I do. So I think we could ask him. Maybe he's not the right person either, but I'm sure he can point us in the right direction if indeed he's not the right person. So we'll get clarification on that.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. So, well, thank you. And I hope members too have gotten a sense from this from the point of view of the Department of Health. You know, we had the quick overview, and members got to see kind of the size of the agency. And so the enormous challenge, even though, you know, the money came in and was available to use, but the management issues here are enormous, and just getting scaling up have been quite the challenge. But they're also, this is kind of not the end of the story either. And I guess one quick thing I'd like to ask Mr. Bunker, maybe you don't know the answer to this right now, but there's been another federal bill, another federal coronavirus relief bill. And my understanding is that there was not money in it for states. So this was sort of not refreshing these coronavirus relief funds, right? Is that kind of your understanding?
Madam Chair, my understanding is that the coronavirus relief fund specifically may not have received an additional allocation. However, there are other federal funds from that latest act of Congress that will be coming into the state. I just don't believe there are any more from the CRF itself. However, we are anticipating additional monies for testing and vaccination.
Okay. Well, I know you all have a lot of work ahead of you as you've had. That's kind of almost ridiculous to say. You have a lot of work ahead of you. Of course you do, but a lot of work also to figure out how these new federal monies can fit in so that we know as a legislature in our budget in this committee what we need to do to help make sure that we get Minnesotans through this pandemic as quickly as possible and with the least possible death and morbidity and the least possible damage to all these things that we hold so dear. And I know you'll be working hard to help us do that. So thank you for your presentation, Mr. Bunker, Deputy Commissioner Kelly, and we appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and we will be back in touch with you as we put our plans together to spend the new federal resources so that you
Great.
Know.
Thank you.
You bet.
Okay, we're going to turn now to DHS, so from the small agency to the larger one, and we're going to have Dave Greeman give us a presentation similar from their point of view. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Greeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dave Greeman. I'm the Budget Director of the Department of Human Services. Before I talk about our federal funds related to COVID, I thought I would just try to respond to the questions about the enhanced federal funding or the enhanced federal match that the state receives. I believe what Representative Bierman was referring to is what we call enhanced FMAP, and the FMAP stands for Federal Medical Assistance Percentage. The way that works is the medical assistance percentage that the federal government pays for Minnesota has typically been about 50%. So for every dollar we spend on medical assistance in Minnesota, with the exception of adults without children, we pay 50 cents and the federal government pays 50 cents. And what the federal government did in the CARES Act that passed in April, I believe, is they said that for every quarter in which, every calendar quarter in which there's a federal public health emergency in place, so it's different than the state peacetime emergency, this is a federal public health emergency, for every month in which that, or every quarter in which that's in place, The FMAP rate for Minnesota goes from 50% to 56.2%. So that means that, and the way that works for the state is it's not actually additional federal money coming into the state, but what we, in for every dollar spent on medical assistance now during this public health emergency, instead of paying 50 cents for every dollar on medical assistance paid, we pay 43.8 cents. And that's how we're saving money. That's the benefit to the state, is it's basically costing us less to deliver medical assistance services under the public health emergency. And that amounts to about $1.065 billion from if you assume it ends in June of 21, from April when it started till June of 21. We assume we're going to receive about $1.065 billion from the federal government. Now, in order to get that additional money or that additional FMAP, we had to do certain things quickly, and we had to rely on the Executive Order 20-12, which was eventually put into law by you all to waive certain rules and statutes in order to ensure that people in Minnesota, in order to make sure that the state meets certain requirements related to maintaining continuous coverage for people in the medical assistance program. And in order to do that, we had to take certain action that resulted in additional costs to the state in order to do that. And the costs for that are around, I believe, about $185 million. That's the cost of maintaining continuous coverage, which we needed to do in order to qualify for the enhanced federal medical assistance percentage. Hopefully that answers your question.
I think it does. Representative Grunhagen, does that answer your question?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, just so... So just as a yes or no answer, is it, yeah, you're smiling, Mrs. Chairman, or Chairman, Madam Chair. So as yes or no, is it tied to the emergency funds or not? I know there's strings attached, but do we have to have emergency powers in force to get that match? Yes or no?
We need to have a federal public health emergency, yes. There needs to be a federal public health emergency in place.
Okay. So, Madam...
Madam, Representative Gruenhagen.
Okay, thank you. But does it have to be emergency powers that is currently being exercised by the governor? If that were to end, would that... we could still receive a match, correct? Under emergency health...
Okay, I'm going to let Mr. Greenman answer that, and then let's move on to something else, because we're getting off topic. Mr. Greenman.
In order for us to receive the enhanced federal match, we need to maintain continuous coverage for people on the medical assistance program. In order to do that, we had to use certain emergency powers, or the commissioner had to use certain emergency powers in order to accomplish that. If we were to take away those emergency powers and she could no longer do that, then we would lose the federal match. We would jeopardize our ability to continue to get the federal match.
Okay. All right.
I'll let staff decipher that, okay?
Yeah. Okay. I think the answer is that things that were the emergency powers were needed for had to happen in order to get the match. It's not the emergency power itself. It's the effect of the emergency power on keeping people enrolled that was necessary to get that match. So it's yes, but it's sort of an indirect yes. Anyway, Mr. Greenman, please continue and let's go through your, I think you only have the one slide, am I correct?
They have a couple behind it with more detail. This is sort of my attempt to put all of the funding and expenditures we've incurred in response to the coronavirus pandemic onto one page. I've tried to separate the expenditures into categories and then also by the type of fund or the type of funding that we received. And so we received both federal and state dollars. And as you can see, that there are three columns showing the federal funds. The first one, I should say the total amount of funding we received and expenditures we incurred are approximately $924 million. And in most cases, this is all for fiscal years 20 and 21. There's some spending going on in 22. But the first fund is the Coronavirus Relief Fund. That's where we've got... more than any other source of funding, what we relied on. And these are funds that, as Mr. Bunker said, this goes through the LAC process. And then in some cases, a limited number of cases, these dollars were direct appropriated to the department by the legislature during some of the special sessions that went on earlier in the summer and the fall. The largest source of funding from the Coronavirus Relief Fund was for childcare. This provided grants to all open operating childcare providers in the state, including centers, family childcare, and then later on to certified centers, not during the whole process, but at a certain point we provided some grants to them as well. So this provided them, this was essentially an effort to help them with additional costs they're incurring to comply with public health regulations, to help them with lost revenue due to fewer children coming in, the other things just to try to help keep this fragile industry going during the pandemic. And we provided grants from July through December to keep these organizations going. A total of $110 million, basically. We also requested about $68 million for food assistance. This was from a variety of grants, which are detailed in subsequent pages. Some of the funding went specifically towards seniors and folks who are homebound. Some of it went to food shelves. And some of it went specifically to tribal governments to help with food assistance. Some of the other big uses of the coronavirus relief funds include providing shelter to people or to providing isolation space for people who are homeless who have symptoms of the coronavirus, or people who are, or also spaces for people who aren't able to, who need to shelter but aren't able to do so at home, or isolate, aren't able to isolate at home. And then we also provided about $42 million for long-term care. Much of this was, about $30 million of this was actually grants to day service providers that the legislature enacted earlier in the summer or the fall, to provide grants to day service providers for their costs associated with continuing to operate during the pandemic, continuing to provide services. We received $24 million for operations costs at the department. This largely went to our direct care and treatment area, where they have staff who can't take time off and have to be at work. And we have to backfill often when staff have to go on leave, either because they've got the coronavirus, or they're caring for someone who has the coronavirus, or they've been exposed to it and they have to isolate. We had significant costs associated with that, sort of keeping our 24/7 operations going through that. We also received federal funds through the Child Care Development Block Grant. This included about $48 million we received in April under the CARES Act. And also we just received $137 million from legislation that Congress passed as part of the fiscal year 21 budget, and the president signed, I think, in late December, December 27th, I think it was. So that's that money, and those dollars flow directly to the department. There's language in statute that directs those dollars to go to the Commissioner of Human Services and for her to spend those dollars. And so these don't go through the LAC process. Although she has reached out to chairs and other key legislators to let them know what we're thinking about in terms of how we're going to use those dollars. We receive targeted federal funds, which means grant dollars that specifically went to Minnesota for particular purposes, like senior nutrition, homelessness, social services block grants, homeless and isolation services, and then most recently for behavioral health. We got a significant amount for behavioral health in this most recent federal legislation. Those dollars are generally allocated to states on a formula basis, and we typically go through the LAC process. Well, we do go through the LAC process to get approval to spend those dollars for specific purposes. The next set of columns is state funding, and those dollars include the COVID Minnesota Fund. We, relative to the Department of Health, we received relatively little from the COVID Minnesota Fund. The biggest portion was for isolation and shelter costs for homeless folks during the pandemic, to create shelter space that was safe for people in the coronavirus, and also for isolation costs for people who needed to stay in a hotel or somewhere else to see if they actually had the condition or not. There was about $84 million in funding provided to the department directly through legislation that you all passed during the regular session and special session as well. As you can see, that went for childcare, food assistance, isolation and shelter, and then long-term care mainly was for increases in rates to the PCA providers. Temporary increases during the pandemic. In addition, as I mentioned earlier, the commissioner was given special authority to waive rules and statutes, both in an executive order and later was passed into law. And some of those waivers that she to enact in order to respond to the coronavirus have fiscal impacts. And so, as you can see, the biggest single fiscal impact is, or the biggest area where the fiscal impact was, is in healthcare. And that's, as I mentioned earlier, that's the cost of maintaining continuous coverage during the pandemic. And that's the $180 million. There are some also some costs we incurred related to things like suspending reassessments of people for cash assistance programs, so they don't have to go through the process of getting reassessed every month or every 6 months, or I think it's every 6 months. And we catch up then later once the pandemic ends, so we suspended those. There's also some funding that we received or that expenditures that were made related to nursing homes and providing them with expedited payments so that the cost of dealing with COVID in their operations could be covered immediately rather than going through the cost-based reimbursement process that requires them to wait 18 months to get reimbursed. Matt, can you go to the second page? So I don't know how much detail you want me to go into in this, but it's quite a bit of detail about—
Yeah, please do not read this slide to us.
No, I won't, I promise. I'll just tell you that the yellow is childcare development block grant. The green is the targeted funds, that's the grant, the dollars that the federal government provided through the CARES Act or through the Family First Coronavirus Relief Act, that we largely received LAC approval to spend. And then the pink represents the coronavirus relief fund dollars. And then on the right, second from the right, is the amount that we received. And then the far right is actually how much money is left at the end of the, as of January 11th. And as you can see, the CCD, the childcare funds are mostly spent, with the exception of the dollars we just received. The same is largely true for the green, the targeted funds. If you look on lines 32, 33, and 34, those are the new dollars that the state just received. And so those funds have not been spent yet, and those are primarily for mental health services. And then we still have some funds that are unspent in the pink areas. Largely, this is, I believe this is some temporary staffing pools that we have in place to, if there's a surge, gives us the authority to put people quickly into the, put workers quickly into those places if we need to. But those funds are still being held. I think as everybody knows, the original end date for the coronavirus relief funds was December 30th of 2020. And that's now been extended for an additional 12 months.
Right. So, Mr. Greenman, I understand that to mean we have more time, but not more money. More.
Madam Chair, that is right. Yes.
Yeah. So.
The last page is.
Okay. And Mr. Greenman, maybe I should stop right here because I do have a question from a member, and I don't know what it relates to. So, Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you. And I just, from what I understand, I just want to, and maybe we heard this wrong, but what I understand for is we don't need to be in an emergency to continue to receive the enhanced funding match. I thought I heard that during the presentation that we need to. There are strings tied to the funding, but having an act of declared emergency is not one of them. That is how... I understand, and other folks too. So I don't know if we heard that wrong or what, but that's not one of the strings attached. And the reason I want to bring a clarification is just for those people who are listening, it's easy to get the two kind of mixed up. So, but I thought I heard that earlier from Mr. Bierman, and that is not what I understand. So,
well, I, Representative Becker, I think Representative Bierman was asking the question. He asked a question about it, and we all got the shared answer. And Mr. Greenman went over that. So I think, are we clear? Unless members are not clear on what the answer was, I think we could probably go on.
Sure,
but
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
No, go ahead, Representative Becker.
I wanted to clarify that. I didn't quite get that, and I appreciate us clarifying that because that's very important. So thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative Becker. Okay, Mr. Greenman, why don't we do that last slide?
Okay, Madam Chair, and if it's helpful, we can provide the federal language that relates to the enhanced FMAP rate that would hopefully clarify this, whatever.
Yeah, I think that would be helpful because obviously there's a lot of interest in this. And I think, too, it would be good to get a summary of, you know, how much money that has meant for the state, because we're not talking about that here exactly, but it's now baked into our budget forecast, and a lot of the more rosy forecasts that we saw in this last forecast was because of that enhanced FMAP. So if you could give that to us afterwards, send that to the committee administrator, we'll get it out to members.
Sure, I can do that, Madam Chair. I don't need to spend much time on this one. This is the state dollars. And so the orange block is essentially the COVID Minnesota funds that we received, which, as I mentioned earlier, mainly for homelessness, serving homeless populations with shelter and isolation, and then also a small amount for tribal food assistance. The green represents the funding that the legislature directly appropriated to us from the general fund. As you can see, the biggest single part of that was for the homeless populations as well, and also for child care grants, and for the period that preceded July, to help keep some of the providers open. And then the yellow represents the expenditures resulting from the emergency powers that the commissioner enacted in order to waive certain rules and statutes in response to the COVID outbreak. And these are what I should say is when she enacts her emergency powers, the chairs and the leads for each committee, each of the relevant committees, the Health and Human Services committees in the House and Senate we have to let them know within 48 hours that we've done it. And then the chairs of those committees have 7 days in which if two chairs object, then that basically vetoes that change. So we do have safeguards in place to make sure that the commissioner is not, that you know, we have transparency and legislative oversight of that work.
Right, and Mr. Greenman, I should just comment here. When I was in Representative Schultz's committee earlier today, the commissioner was kind of asked about something about that, and I was having audio problems at the time, so I couldn't hop in, but I just wanted to let members know that Commissioner Harpstead is on the phone with me and with Senator Benson so much that we almost like, again, really? She is really quite the communicator. So I do want to assure people that even though she hasn't been able to communicate with the entire legislature, obviously, while we were not in session and having those special sessions, she has been very diligent in communicating all of these changes and discussing them, not only communicating them, I must say, but a very unusual thing, actually consulting us before she put them in place, which is a rare thing in the relationship between the executive branch and the legislative branch. So I know that Senator Benson would say the very same thing. So just wanted to throw that in. So, Mr. Greenman, then, was there, you were at the end of your presentation, am I correct?
Madam Chair, yes, I am. I'm happy to answer questions if members have them.
Okay. So, are there questions for members? And while we're waiting to see if there are any questions, I would just say that I hope that nobody who's on this committee has changed their mind about the wisdom of that decision after looking at all of this detail and data. There will be a lot more policy discussions that we will have, but it is important, I think, to just not for all of you to memorize or be able to discuss each of these lines of spending, but just to have an appreciation of the complexity of all of this and the big challenge that these agencies have had and that we've all had in trying to manage the pandemic. I do think, Mr. Greenman, maybe you can mention, and I do have a couple questions here from members, but there will be an audit. Am I right that the feds require an audit of all the spending of this coronavirus money, both in DHS and MD, well, all of it, right?
Madam Chair, absolutely. Yes, there is a federal audit. The MMB is, as the sort of central financial agency, is in charge of collecting the information from each of the recipient agencies and compiling it, pulling it together for reporting purposes to the federal government. So yes, there will be an audit.
Okay, so we're gonna have Representative Pryor and then Bierman. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a quick question and I think the answer is no, but I just wanted to ask, because I'm so anxious to find out, is there any word about receiving the continuation of money for the child care grants? Because I know we think it's coming, but that we have not, that the money's not been received yet.
Mr. Greenman?
Any
Madam
word?
Chair, Representative Pryor, the funding for the child care allocation that the state is set to receive from the Child Care Development Block Grant, and that happened in this late December legislation that passed. We've not officially received a letter of award yet for those funds. We do believe, based on the formula that has been used in the past and was used last time we got COVID funding for child care, that we'll receive about $137 million, but we haven't received official word yet. And once we get that money, there's already discussions about what's the best way to use that money to support the industry and to support families. So those discussions are going on. We certainly recognize how important those grants have been to providers throughout the state to keep them going. And so I think we're looking at, you know, what's the best way to allocate those funds.
All right, thank you. And so we only have about 3 minutes left, but Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At the risk of raising the ire of the chair, I just need to bring that issue up one more time, as long as Mr. Greenman is still on the line. I just wanted to understand the issue of the Executive Order 2012. The impact of that being in place is what it makes a certain order to waive certain statutes that allow us to get an enhanced federal match for MA, which is what provides a little extra money to the state. Whereas if we don't have that executive order in place, we would not get that extra match. Is that close?
Mr. Yes. Greenman?
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, that's correct. What eventually happened, the Executive Order 20-12 was actually put into law. So it's actually in law now too. And we actually, and the law also says that we have the authority, the state DHS has the authority to continue any waivers that we need to in order to continue to receive the federal matching rate, or the enhanced FMAP rate. So yes.
Very good.
Right. Yeah. Thank you for clarifying that, Representative Bierman. So to put it another way, it was required at one time, but probably not anymore, to have the emergency powers in place because we codified it so that we can continue to receive that money now, even if the emergency powers themselves were to go away. Right? Mr. Greenman, he's nodding yes. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, you gave the best explanation yet, okay?
Oh, good. Glad to hear that. That's glad to be of help there, Representative Gruenhagen. All right. Well, with that, members, thank you very much for your attention. And we will be, I don't have in my on my list here, I don't have our agenda for next week, but we will not have a hearing on Monday, so our next hearing will be Tuesday. So enjoy Martin Luther King Day, and we'll see you back on Tuesday. Thank you. We are adjourned.